You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. It isn't always easy to get kids excited about doing math and science, but our guest today has found a way to make it active and fun, too. He trained to compete on the NBC show American Ninja Warrior, and he brought students in on the process. He showed them the math and science of the obstacles in the course to give real-life examples of what they were learning in school. Jay Flores is a global STEM ambassador and founder of Invent the Change, his organization that works to promote STEM education. That stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. He grew up in Milwaukee, graduated from UW-Madison. To raise awareness for his cause, he's competing in this season of American Ninja Warrior. Earlier this month, he advanced to the semifinals in Los Angeles. Jay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
What got you so interested in promoting the science, technology, engineering, math to the next generation?
So it's something that I grew up being pretty good at in school, but never really knowing why it was important. I was the student that asked the question, why would I ever use this again in my life? And as I got through my engineering education and I got to get out into the real world, I saw how many cool examples there were of how things were being made and how things were changing the world. And I thought that more people should have the opportunity to be prepared to do those things themselves as well. But I didn't see it in my community and I didn't see it celebrated in a lot of places. So I tried to find unique, fun ways to get students involved.
Yeah. What are some of the things you'd like to do when you're talking to youth who might ask you that question you grew up asking, what's this got to be good for? How do you make it interesting for them if they're not necessarily going for it right away?
So I try to lead with what they might already be passionate about. I can walk into a room of students or a conference and ask any person what they're passionate about, and there's some type of science or technology behind it impacting how it's created or how it's produced today. So I want to connect with what they already care about and then show them that a STEM career could allow them to go very far in that space, whether that be creating cars, curing cancer, or even playing sports. There's opportunities for everyone in STEM.
And so you're an ambassador for STEM education. What does that mean? What does that look like in your day-to-day job?
Every day is a little different. Every day is fun. As I mentioned, I try to find those real life examples and find examples that are as entertaining as they are educational. So one fun example that I do from home and in my kitchen actually is a series that I created called It's Not Magic, It's Science, where they're at home science experiments that are disguised as magic tricks. And I put them out on my social media channels. And that's one way to reach students and parents that weren't maybe already looking for science, but found it in a cool way, to conferences and events, to the TV shows that have done a wide variety of ways of just really trying to celebrate science so that our society can get the best of the minds of young kids that are curious and just haven't found the real life examples yet.
Talking to Jay Flores, UW-Madison engineering graduate who promotes science, technology, engineering, and math education for kids. STEM, they call it for short. Okay, Jay, speaking of fun lessons, now you worked for years to get on American Ninja Warrior. You ultimately got to do it. And part of this was coming with some science lessons and math lessons, I think, for the kids. How did you turn those stunts into lessons?
Absolutely. One of the cool things and challenging things about the show is that nobody gets to touch the course before you compete. And as you mentioned, it took me 10 years of trying to apply to finally get the call for the show. And so when you're taking on a course, whether that's at a local gym or on the show, being able to analyze the obstacles and try to understand how they work as well as how your body works in those situations can provide you with a competitive advantage. So I actually started with using it as something to make me a better ninja without necessarily the time of training. And then I figured this might be a fun way to get more kids active while also promoting STEM. And it was a really good mix of learning by play. And students, I think, were very excited about being able to become a better ninja and have some good examples of why the things they learned in math or geometry or physics really matter in the real world.
I understand in one of the rounds in San Antonio, you had some students bring robots to the stage. What were the robots there for?
Yes, that was incredible. We brought robots on our B-roll day where we filmed kind of my backstory. I got to do some pull-ups with a robot from a team that competes in FIRST, which is a robotics competition for youth. And the next day we had them on stage when I came out, and we had an all-girls team from San Antonio along the sideline with the robot, kind of going along the sideline with my family and my wife, celebrating anytime I completed an obstacle. The girls had the robot do donuts and cool things. So they really did a great job of bringing it to life. And that's, I think, what is wonderful about the spirit of Ninja Warrior. It is you versus the course, but there's also so many great stories that are told. And I really wanted to amplify the students and the incredible the work that they're doing, and especially the young girls that are doing great things in STEM.
Let's bring in a caller. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I didn't realize I was going to get on right away. I am wondering why STEAM is not picking up STEAM, meaning the A in art or the arts, because the arts are, you need the science, technology, math, engineering in almost any art. Mm. I mean, they all apply. And I'm wondering why that's not picking up as much STEAM.
I gotcha, Susie. Thanks a lot. Yeah, so adding arts to STEM to make it STEAM. I've seen projects with that. Whether you bring it in directly, I think the creative element of science and math is something that people often overlook.
Absolutely. And so the way I like to look at it is engineering, the STEM fields, it's just problem solving. And you get to decide the types of problems you want to solve. So early on in my career, I worked with manufacturers and their automation challenges. And now I work with families and kids to get them engaged in science and solve that challenge that we have as a nation and as a world to innovate, to solve the problems that we're facing. So I think the key is for teachers and parents to lead with curiosity versus math and science skills. So celebrate and encourage that creativity and curiosity. And eventually, if they're excited and they keep going down that path, they'll learn the math and science skills they need in order to succeed, whether that be in an artistic way, in a traditional manufacturing way, whichever way that they want to solve problems.
Thanks a lot for that call, Susie. Jay, I don't want to leave people hanging. You, after years, got onto the American Ninja Warrior program. It's this, if people haven't seen it, it's this thing where you do these crazy stunts. As you said, you don't get to know what you're going to do before you do it. What was the experience like?
It was incredible. And if you're familiar with any type of TV shows, they look incredible on TV. And in the background, when you're making it, it's a little bit hectic and crazy. And so I was there at the start line and I had to wait. Actually, they decided to take a break. And it's almost like icing a kicker in football, if not worse. And so I was standing there and I just tried to soak it in and think about all the challenges and the things that took to get there, but also the incredible opportunity. And view those rejections as part of the journey of making it so much more special. And I was lucky to make it and advance to semifinals there in front of my friends and family and all the students. And probably sometime in July, if not early August, they'll air semifinals. And hopefully we'll be able to get some airtime there as well.
And Jay, just in our last few moments, can you leave us with lessons maybe for a parent or a teacher listening to help jazz up that STEM education, spark that interest in the kids they work with?
I think everyone is born an engineer. From the time we open our eyes, everything is an experiment. We're very curious naturally. And at some point, unfortunately, society or rejection or failure or a bad grade or a teacher that may have said something kind of puts us down a certain path that we don't think we can be math people. And we don't do the same thing when it comes to challenges with tying shoes, right? So why would we tell someone they're not a math person? We help them and guide them down that path. So anytime you have an opportunity to celebrate curiosity or creativity, allow the youth to ask the question why, even if you don't know the answer, just allow them to explore and experiment. And eventually, you know, later down the road, they'll still be open to exploring these fields, and they'll be much more prepared and ready to take on the harder math and science because they're curious and they're excited about it.
Jay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Jay Flores is originally from Milwaukee, UW-Madison graduate, competing on this season of the NBC show American Ninja Warrior, and a global STEM ambassador who promotes math and science education through his company Invent the Change. Coming up, we meet a pair of bread bakers from the UK and hear the story of how they crowdfunded their own shop. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. A lot of people turned to baking during the early days of the pandemic as a way to gain some mental and emotional relief in a tough time and to make some delicious bread. Our next guests had already discovered the healing power of baking. They're a daughter and father team who started baking at home and ended up opening a bakery. In their new book, they share their story and a lot of recipes and tell us how baking bread helped them through a difficult time. Kitty and Al Tate are daughter and father. Together, they run the Orange Bakery in Oxfordshire in the UK. Their new book is called Bread Song, How Baking Changed Our Lives. I talked with them yesterday. Kitty, can you share some of the story about how you got into baking?
So growing up, I was always a horrible, horrible baker. I mean, like, if I told people that I was baking, everyone in the house would just make excuses that day to not be around. And I'd make fairy cakes, which I used to get confused between, like, bicarb and baking powder, and they just dry your whole mouth out. Mm-hmm. Or my cookies always seem to be rock hard, even though they're in the oven for about 2 minutes. But then when I was 14, I started to really struggle with anxiety and depression. And I don't know what caused it. It felt like it just came out of nowhere, but it was just crushing. And I couldn't go to school. I couldn't leave the house. Sometimes I couldn't even leave my room. And then one day I watched my dad make a loaf of bread. And it wasn't spectacular. He just mixed flour, water, salt, and a tiny bit of yeast together. And it looked like this gloopy mess. And I kind of took the mick out of him because I was like, ew, I'm not eating that. But the next day he scooped it out and he baked it. And the loaf that came out was just, it was golden and it was warm and it was soft. And it made me feel safe. And I think I hadn't really felt safe for a long time. I'm quite obsessive. So I got dad to teach me how to make that loaf. And I started to make loaf after loaf after loaf. And things escalated very quickly after that.
Al, from your perspective, can you talk about how you saw Kitty embrace baking and what it meant for her?
Yeah, it was one of these things that was never intentional. So very little of our journey has ever been intentional, actually, looking back. But with the baking, it was quite by chance that Kitty happened to be watching me when I was baking a loaf. And Kitty talks about her baking. My loaf baking was pretty unspectacular, too, until I sort of found this amazing Jim Leahy method. And Kitty's depression and anxiety had basically brought the whole family to quite a crushing halt. And we tried everything and anything to sort of pull her out of the kind of bleakness and blackness that she was in, and seeing her respond to the baking was wonderful, because you just, for that small little moment, we just got a glimpse of the old Kitty. It was a very, very special moment.
Kitty, I think a lot of people have turned to baking for some comfort over the years. What is it about baking in particular that was so magical for you?
I think it's kind of two things. The first is it completely takes your mind away from yourself. For me, I just had all these thoughts spinning around my head the whole time. And when I was baking, I had to be present and I had to be concentrating on what I was doing. And it's so sensory too. Yes, it's sight, but it's also touch and it's taste and it's hearing. There's so many things that I love about it, but it takes all of you. It takes all of your attention, and I really needed that. And I think the second thing is, at the end of this process and task, you have something. I mean, you don't walk away with nothing. It's not just a fun activity. You have a product, and you can either eat that product yourself, or you can give it to someone or share it with someone, and that's really beautiful, and I love that.
Al, this went from eating the loaves yourselves or sharing them, as Kitty just said, to a bakery. What led you to go all in with Kitty and take this, this hobby / therapy and turn it into this business?
Yeah. So Kitty's basically a force of nature, and you have to go with that. And so the fact that it went from sharing with neighbours to pop up to then the shop was an extraordinary journey, an amazing sort of momentum. And it was driven by all sorts of different factors. I mean, partly demand. You know, people really wanted our bread, which is an amazing sort of experience. And partly because it was the most important crutch for Kitty to get better. And therefore, we were always going to go with anything that could do that. But as I said sort of earlier, there's been very little deliberate decision behind our sort of whole process. So even taking the shop on, I think I secretly thought in the back of my head, well, this is lovely, but real life will.
And we had a deal when we got offered a shop, because again, like Dad said, we never planned it. But our deal was, if we could raise enough money, we could open the shop. And we had about £200, which is not enough to open a shop. So we decided to crowdfund. And the lovely thing about crowdfunding is, if you don't hit your target, it all gets returned, no losses. And we set a target. We gave ourselves 3 weeks. And I think Dad was secretly hoping like we'd maybe nearly reach it and then just not quite. And then they'd put everything to bed. But we hit our target within 48 hours. And at the end of the 3 weeks, we had doubled it.
And it's an extraordinary validation, really. You suddenly think, gosh, there are all these people, you know, we might have known maybe 50, 60% of them, but there were so many people who we'd never met before, but who'd somehow heard of our story or eaten our bread, who believed in us. And I think that was the critical thing, was realizing there were people out there who felt that this was possible. And that kind of, it did a lot to overcome my kind of natural doubt and conservatism.
We're talking to Kitty and Al Tate. They are a daughter and father team. They run the Orange Bakery in the UK. Their new book is called Bread Song, How Baking Changed Our Lives. Well, let's check out a recipe, Kitty. And this is, I think, a good one for people to start with. We have it online at WPR.org/Food Friday, the Miracle Overnight White Loaf. I need some miracles, I think, in my bread baking. How does this recipe work?
So this is the first recipe in the book, and it's still my favorite. All you need is flour, water, salt, and a tiny bit of yeast. You mix it up. Normally you can do this in the evening. You doesn't have to knead it. You literally have a spoon. It takes 3 minutes. Then you put a cloth over the top, and you leave it for about 12 hours. So like I say, overnight's best. And then in the morning, you just scoop it out, and you can put it into a tin or a tray if you want to make focaccia or whatever you want, and bake it. It's so simple. It's so easy. It's the first loaf I made. I love it. And it makes amazing bread.
And Al, Kitty mentioned earlier, she's kind of making fun of your product before this whole process started. Have you, can you talk about your evolution as a baker through it? I know Kitty has really embraced it. Have you gotten to be a better baker along the way too?
Yeah, I've had a nice time in Kitty's slipstream, basically. So I've learned an enormous amount from her. I mean, we basically...
You bounce off each other very well.
And we love the sort of... A huge amount of our bread baking journey has been built on failure. And you learn so much from failing the whole time. And the brilliant thing about bread is it's not like ruining a cake. It's quite... bread is quite simple. It's quite cheap. So you can make mistakes and sort of, you know, pull yourself back from it. So...
If you have to give a loaf of bad bread to the pigs, it's okay. If you have to give like a whole Victoria sponge cake to a pig, that's a lot harder.
Yeah. So it's been great. No, I love it. I've always been a huge bread fan. I still am a huge bread fan. And the fact that I'm getting a chance to make bread and I don't have Kitty's extraordinary sort of intuition and instinct for it. But I'm getting there.
You're definitely getting there.
Now, we've got another recipe online at WPR.org/Food Friday for your sourdough focaccia. Now, we don't need to talk about the recipe, but I want to meet another character in your book, a fella named Ferguson, a sourdough starter, Kitty.
The best kind of fella. So Ferguson was my first starter. And when I first started baking, like I said, I wasn't doing sourdough or anything fancy like that. But the more we sold our bread, the more people started to ask, can you do sourdough? I'd love to buy a loaf. So it was like this challenge, like this mountain that I needed to climb. And I decided that I had to complete sourdough. So I taught myself, I learned everything I could online through books and YouTube videos, and I made a sourdough starter out of just flour, water, and the skin of an apple from our garden, because that has all the lovely natural microbiomes around it. And I mixed it all together and I named him Ferguson. I got very emotionally attached to Ferguson, and I would even sleep downstairs next to him. So I made sure that he wouldn't like suddenly die in the night, or it was the opposite actually. I'd be fast asleep at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock and I'd hear this farting as Ferguson just explodes over the jar.
Oh, that's a great story to leave it with. Kitty and Al, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Yeah.
Been talking to Al and Kitty Tate. They're a father and daughter team. They run the Orange Bakery in the United Kingdom. I talked with them yesterday about their new book. It's called Bread Song, How Baking Changed Our Lives. You can find recipes from their book, including that miracle overnight white loaf, sourdough focaccia, and one we didn't talk about at all, next level Chelsea buns, on our website at wpr.org/foodfriday. Now, if you have a baking story to share, if you find a bread baking or other kinds of baking therapeutic, an important part of your mental health, love to hear from you. If you identified with the story that you just heard there, let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Again, that email, ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, an engineer made headlines when he claimed that a Google system, that the company Google, had become a sentient artificial intelligence. Now, it looks like it probably didn't, actually, but the possibility raises a lot of questions for the future. We'll tackle the issue of artificial intelligence, when it might be on the way, what it means for us humans. And pinball is a lot of fun, even though I'm bad at it, but it's more than just a game. We'll dig into the art and the cultural influence of pinball through the decades. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, Mayo Clinic says we need to eat 20 to 30 grams of fiber every day. Do you know if you're getting enough? A gastroenterologist tells us what we can do to make our gut happy and why it affects a lot of aspects of our health. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a gastroenterologist helps us understand the mysteries of our guts and how we can feel better by eating the right stuff. First, the January 6th House hearings continue as today marked the fourth public hearing this month. The committee discussed former President Trump's pressure campaign when he urged state officials and state legislatures to, quote, find the votes that would swing voting results in his favor for the 2020 presidential election. Today's hearings also discussed the threats made to state and local officials who would not comply to Trump's pressure campaign. Let's take a moment to listen to some of those threats shared publicly in today's hearings.
Public pressure on state officials often grew dangerous in the lead up to January 6th.
Let us in! Let us in! Let us in! Let us in!
Special session!
We'll light the whole shit on fire.
What are we going to do? What can you and I do as state legislators besides kill them? Although we should not do that. I'm not advising that, but I mean, what else can you do, right?
The punishment for treason is death.
At the hearing, members of the House said Trump's false claims about election fraud helped create the violence of what became the January 6th Capitol attack. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to what came out of today's hearings? Did anything surprise you? What are your thoughts on the pressure campaign toward officials in a number of states? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here again. Thank you to the audience.
Well, what we learned more about today was, I think, the extent of the campaign to pressure officials in state legislatures, secretaries of state, and others. What stood out to you along those lines, David?
To me, what stood out to me was a quote by Rudy Giuliani at one point, who said, we have lots of theories, but not a lot of evidence regarding fraud, or something to that effect. And why I mention that is because what we had across states like Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, which came out today, is that there are all kinds of theories being cooked up regarding voter fraud, all types of theories being cooked up about how maybe alternate electors could be picked, or how people could throw out the results of an election or decertify it. These were the theories, but there was no evidence to support any of the claims about fraud. And so to me, that quote sums up a lot today. But I also want to say, and again, when you did the introduction, you pointed out I teach election law also at the University of Minnesota. I've been teaching election law for 25 years. And when I was listening to the testimony today, I thought to myself, nobody in their right mind would think that any of these theories had any merit. And the Speaker of the House from Arizona, I think, brought that up really well by saying, there's no evidence, there's no theory. You're asking me to do something that has never been done in American history. That's what stood out for me today.
I want to listen to Arizona Republican State House Speaker Rusty Bowers. He said he did not tell Trump that Trump had won Arizona, contrary to a statement from the former president just earlier today. Here is Bowers saying a member of Congress had also urged him to overturn Arizona's results.
And what did Mr. Biggs ask you to do?
I believe that was the day that the vote was occurring, to each state to have certification, or to declare the certification of the electors. And he asked if I would sign on both to a letter that had been sent from my state, and or that I would support the decertification of the electors. And I said I would not.
Let's talk more about House Speaker Rusty Bowers from Arizona, Republican, conservative. Can you talk about his testimony, what he said about the pressure from the president, members of Congress, as we just heard, and others?
It was a powerful testimony, and it's also important to underscore that he said he voted for Trump in 16, voted for Trump in 20, wanted him to win. But he started to describe this intense pressure being brought to bear upon him in terms of what recalls from the White House, in terms of, I'm going to maybe use the word almost like haranguing from Mayor Giuliani. And what he described here was how there were claims that there were about 200,000 people who had voted illegally, including dead people voting, illegal immigrants, et cetera, undocumented individuals. And he asked for proof of this. And Giuliani never forwarded it, and then asked for justification, argument for why he should be able to decertify the election. And pressed arguments to him, that is by Giuliani. And when he was pushed back, that is when the speakers pushed back and said, we've never been asked to do this before. It was just the intensity of the pressure that I think that was so interesting. And I thought, and I'd be curious what the listeners think too, I thought his testimony was just intensely powerful in terms of somebody who said, I supported Trump, but I took an oath of office to the Constitution, and I had to follow what the Constitution says. I think that was pretty powerful testimony in terms of describing his role and in terms of describing the unprecedented level of pressure upon state officials when there's no legal or factual basis to support the claims.
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota about today's January 6th committee hearing in the U.S. House. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi, I've been listening on the radio, Wisconsin Public Radio, to the hearings today, January 6th committee, and I did hear Ron Johnson's name come up quite a few times, but I'm really not clear what his role is in all of this, and I was wondering if your guests could articulate that for us.
Yeah, that Michael, thanks for bringing that up. The committee shared a text thread from Senator Johnson's aide, is newly appointed that day chief of staff on January 6th, 2021. Text, Johnson needs to hand something to V. POTUS, Vice President of the United States. Please advise. That's going to a Mike Pence staffer. The staffer replies, what is it? Riley, the Johnson staffer, says alternate slate of electors for MI and WI because archivist didn't receive them. And then the Penn staffer says, do not give that to him. So an apparent offer from a Johnson staffer, a Senator Johnson staffer, to bring these so-called alternate electors, a phony or fake electors, people are calling them. David, a lot of people in Wisconsin watching this, what do you think?
This is pretty significant because if this is accurate in terms of this recount, this is starting to connect now Senator Ron Johnson to this larger process of a legal theory of trying to say we can submit alternative electors. Even though we know that this is illegal or not possible to do this, and part of this larger argument that's being made today that the whole idea of fabricating a alternative set of electors, of questioning the certification, was really meant to undermine confidence and create confusion going into Congress, with the hope then that Mike Pence would say, well, we can't be sure, you know, who are the right electors at this point. And so this is important because this is now potentially connecting a member of Congress, again, a representative, senator from Wisconsin, to this broader, let's say, conspiracy involving January 6th.
Johnson's office put out a statement today, quoting here, the senator had no involvement in the creation of an alternate set of electors and had no foreknowledge is going to be delivered to our office. This is a staff-to-staff exchange. His new chief of staff contacted the vice president's office, end quote, going on saying, they said we didn't want it, so we didn't bring it to them, but not denying that there was an offer to transmit that slate of electors. Members of the House committee said, maybe we do want to talk to Senator Johnson about this, but I think that's about where they left it on that. Now, talking about this so-called fake elector thing. Now, some of the people involved here in Wisconsin said, we weren't trying to do something that was going to affect January 6th directly. We were saying, if these court challenges, even if they're long shots, if these court challenges tip the balance toward Donald Trump in Wisconsin, here we are. We need to be registered as electors in case things change. We need Republican electors. How is that ultimately used leading up to January 6th?
Well, how it's used at this – well, first off, by the way, by the time we still have these fake electors being talked about, it's well past the court challenges are done, well past the certification of the election. So at this point, there really is no reason to keep sort of pushing this idea of alternative electors that are out there. On top of which, what was happening is that they were submitting fraudulent documents saying that what they in fact were the rightfully chosen electors. So this is a problem with fraud. And so all of this fits into January 6th in a couple of ways. One, in terms of creating supposedly the confusion that would give the vice president justification to say, we just don't know who the correct electors are in Wisconsin. Therefore, let's set them to the side. Let's maybe have an investigation or something like that. But also this fed into the narrative leading into the speech for Donald Trump on January 6th is saying we have what? We have widespread voter fraud out there, or officials are doing things to prevent legitimate electors, that is our electors, from being seated. So this is where it fits in. Although we don't have the full pieces or all the pieces of the puzzle in place yet, this is where it seems to be going at this point.
David Schultz is with us, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to talk about today's January 6th public hearings and claims of election fraud from then-President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics, looking at today's hearing of the House January 6th Committee. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Love the show. Anyway, I was just kind of wondering why people are believing all this crap, you know, even whether you like Trump or you don't, or you wanted Biden or you don't, or whatever, because I've got some friends that are convinced, well, the one passed away, but when he was still alive, and his wife is still alive, but they were convinced that Biden stole the election, and they were just totally convinced about it. Just like with the coronavirus, they're convinced that there's stuff, and they're not going to take it because they believe this stuff. Now, why do people believe, those are just two good incidences, but why do people believe that there's all this junk about those two things or anything, but not want to, you know, go research it first to see, did Biden really do this? Is there aborted fetuses in this coronavirus or anything else? They did, you know, in the shot or anything else.
Gotcha, Samantha. Thanks for the call. So, David, we have this contrast in real time. We're hearing tape of Georgia officials patiently explaining what had happened in their election. That information was there in real time. But there is a reality, as Samantha says, that a lot of people still believe a lot of the claims that were being debunked as early as December of 2020. Yeah.
Okay, a couple of things going on here. First off, when the president of the United States says something, generally that person carries a lot of weight in terms of what they have to say. We want to hope that they're truthful, that they're credible. And also, the president of the United States gets a lot of media attention. And so for a lot of people, if the president says something, they're going to naturally believe him. I think a second thing that's going on here is the fact that we clearly have bubbles that we live in. We've talked all about this, you know, that we live in our little bubbles on the social media. We live in our bubbles with our friends and so forth. And everybody else around us believes the same thing. If all of my friends are saying, I voted for Donald Trump, and you're wondering, my gosh, everybody I know voted for Donald Trump. How could Biden have won? And then finally, you know, we're looking at, a media environment now that is so fragmented that you have what, Fox News, for example, that's broadcasting one set of facts or one set of opinions regarding what happened. So put these all together, the bubbles, the president speaking, sort of the bully pulpit that he gets, and sort of, let's say, the fractured media, those become pretty powerful, and they help reinforce what cognitive scientists say is what our own confirmation biases. We look out there, we search for information that confirms our biases. And so all kinds of reasons why that's happening. And to this day, we have lots of people who are still probably saying, well, gosh, I still think the election was stolen because the ex-president says so. All my friends voted for Trump. I think that's partly what's going on here. Certainly not a definitive answer, but part of the answer.
Thanks for the call. Just before we go back to callers, a running theme today was whether it's a elected Republican in Arizona or Georgia or election officials. We heard from Shay Moss and then tape testimony from her mom, Ruby Freeman. The threats, the harassment in person, at their houses, death threats, rape threats to spouses that came out of all of this. What did we see there today?
Yeah, well, it's probably bad enough that we saw efforts to try to come up with fabricated theories or fabricated evidence, but this was really kind of, I don't know, thuggish behavior also we're hearing about here, where people, even including longstanding Republicans, not that it's justified for anybody, but including people who are longstanding Republicans, were essentially, you know, threatened. I mean, as I'm listening to it, I think of the words like thuggery, or I think of what, almost like extortion, or it sort of sounded like, I don't know, almost like an organized crime type of effort to try to pressure people or threaten people. And that's a pretty scary notion that's coming out in terms of these threats of force, these threats of coercion against officials or their family or children. This is the first, I think, really today that I've really heard of that. And I think it's one of the more depressing or dark bits of new information that came out today.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I think you'll agree with me that Trump was president officially until January 20th. So he had a responsibility as the executive branch to make sure that the election was fair and whatnot. So my question is this. If Trump was so wrong in asking for a delay in the Electoral College vote to investigate claims of fraud, why did several U.S. senators agree with him and urge the same thing, including Ted Cruz and other senators? I think there was close to a dozen senators urging a delay in the Electoral College vote.
Jeff, thanks for the call. There were other senators. I believe Senator Johnson had planned to at least object to some of the counts as well, but changed after the insurrection. David, the role of some Republican U.S. senators also asking for a delay.
Okay, first I want to point out and say that by the time we got to January 6th, we had already had extensive litigation, I think over 60 cases brought that Trump had lost. There had been recounts, there had been state certifications, so that by the time we got to January 6th, it was overwhelming. That there was no voter fraud, there was no dispute at this point. Trump had his opportunity through his attorneys and he lost. Now, part of what I'm thinking we're going to start to hear now moving forward after today's hearing is who else was involved? Who else has been involved in terms of any types of conspiratorial action?
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Tom now in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. I think in the full course of time, it will be revealed that Donald Trump's life was a criminal enterprise from the get-go. But the point I want to make is that we have here in Wisconsin a member of our Wisconsin Elections Commission, Bob Spindell, who served as a false and faithless elector. And he has not been disciplined, sanctioned, or removed from that body. And I have a big problem with that. This guy who's on a board to oversee our elections participated in outright fraudulent activity.
Tom, thanks for the call. David, is it inherently fraudulent for that? He is right. Bob Spindell is on the Elections Commission, also one of the would-be electors. Is it fraud, as Tom suggests? And you might have to get a bit lawyerly here. I don't know.
Okay. Is it fraud? I don't think it's fraud per se. Could there be conflicts of interest? Could there have been something that he could be prosecuted for in terms of fraud in a different – I guess I'm going to rephrase myself here and say that there could be criminal fraud if, in fact, he tried to do certain things that he knew were deceptive with the effort of trying to maybe obstruct a governmental proceeding or deceive public officials. So in that sense, maybe you're right. Maybe it is the caller's right. Maybe there is some type of criminal fraud here about that action. Him serving on the board, though, may be a different issue about conflicts of interest. But you may have both of those issues potentially applying to him.
Thanks for the call. We heard from Chris in Prairie du Sac, who wonders if the outcome of the hearings here might or might not lead to former President Trump being charged with something. What are your thoughts on what would go into making that decision? Won't ask you to predict what's going to happen, though.
Sure. I've always thought that the hearings from the opening night with Representative Cheney sounded like the beginning of a criminal trial, her opening statement and laying out the arguments. And potentially the president could be charged with efforts to try to obstruct or impede a government proceeding, that is the counting of electoral votes. He could be, and there's been investigations in Georgia regarding was he trying to intimidate public officials. And depending on where they go, these hearings could, and we don't know, could lead to an indictment of the president or the former president of the United States. That's one of the possible end games for these hearings. And we're just going to have to see if that's where it goes.
And briefly, what are you watching for now? The next hearing scheduled for Thursday afternoon.
What I'm looking for at this point is, again, now trying to connect in. Perhaps connect in some members of Congress, trying to connect in the efforts between what was done at the state level and what done at the congressional level. But mostly I'm looking to see how they start to now show a broader conspiracy, starting to connect all these different things that we're seeing out there. The January 6th riot, what the president was doing, what at the federal level, what's happening with Pence, what's happening at the state level. Can they now start to tie all this together? That's what I want to see.
David, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and of law at the University of Minnesota, author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David joined us to talk about today's January 6th hearings and former President Trump's 2020 pressure campaign. Coming up after the news, a gut health expert gives us some tips on keeping our digestive systems in shape and what that can do for our overall health as well. Plus some food advice, what to eat, what not to eat. I never do this. But coffee? Which list is it on? We'll find out. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. That was a tease, eh?